it seems, to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? If you're new to the show, welcome. If you're not new to the show, welcome back. It's been a while. I'm glad to have another show to share with you, another conversation to share with you today. It's a fun one and a little off the beaten path compared to the last few weeks. Today on the show, I'm talking to Anastasia French, who is part of the Living Wage for Families organization out here in British Columbia. And we're going to be talking about all things living wage, earning a living wage as an employee, paying a living wage as an employer, what that might mean as a customer, that kind of a thing. And it's a really good conversation, a very timely conversation. No matter where you are in the world, prices have gone up. Things have gotten more expensive. Our paychecks are covering less and less. And if you're making well below what it takes to make rent and buy food, this is a hard time these days. And we're going to talk about that with Anastasia. Her organization does some really interesting work, part of a network of groups across Canada. And we're going to learn a lot more about that in a few minutes' time. Before then, just wanted to say hi and say thank you again for everyone that is supporting the show, supporting the hosting of the show through really voluntary donations. That's how this show gets funded. It's listeners like you that keep this show afloat. It's been a couple of weeks since the last fresh new podcast episode, but the weird thing about podcasting is that the expenses are consistent. They come up every month, whether there's new shows or not. And so for those of you that have signed up for a few dollars a month to keep the show going, I really do appreciate it, especially in this time where there haven't been new shows for a couple of weeks because the bills keep coming in. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention bakersforbakers.org. That's bakers, number four, bakers.org. That's the free online community for bakers, professional bakers and bakery owners to come together and share their experiences and to share what they know and ask questions about what they don't know and to help each other out and support each other. And the costs for running Bakers for Bakers is also covered by the same folks that support the show through the same mechanism. So when you go to riseuppod.com and you click support the show, you're helping each other out in two ways. You get to keep these shows online for folks to download and listen to again after the fact if they want to go back and cover off things again. And it also covers the cost of running Bakers for Bakers. And it's getting more and more active. There's getting more and more members. And it costs more to run the more people that are using it. But the value that folks get out of that forum, if you haven't been over there and checked it out, you really should go sign up at bakersforbakers.org because it's amazing. There are folks building out new bakeries and asking for advice. There are folks that are kind of hitting a wall with their existing operation and looking for a way to kind of rethink of problems, reframe issues so that they can find a new way forward at the shop. And they're getting some amazing help from their peers on the forums. And then roughly once a month, I host a roundtable call where we all get on Zoom. Whoever's available gets on Zoom and we talk about different topics. If there's a little bit of bounce in my voice here, it's because I just got off a call, the July call this afternoon. And if you haven't had a chance to join a Baker roundtable call, let me give you the lowdown. This is kind of what happened. We had a dozen people on the call from all over Canada and the U.S. in this case. Over the course of the hour that we were together, we got to drill deep on three kind of bigger topics. We had a discussion about pricing and credit card charges and tipping and rules around tipping and tipping culture in different areas, and how that relates to your credit card fees and setting up your Square terminals, that kind of stuff. Then we got into talking about product lineups and menus and how often you change your menus and what's that balance point and how do people find that balance point between giving customers the reassurance that their favorite thing is going to be in the display case when they come in and the need for some creativity and some excitement and some anticipation that there might be new products in the display case that you've never seen before. And how do you find that balance and what are different folks do at their bakeries? And then we got into a really interesting discussion about sort of setting targets and standards and goals around production and saying, like, how can we get more efficient as a team? How can we do more in the same amount of time? And how does the team grow and feel empowered by these kind of targets and by these kind of goals and not feel like they're being micromanaged and browbeaten into working faster? And how do you find that balance, and how do you sort of frame the conversation, and how do you get your team involved in sort of raising the standard for everyone? And that was really neat. Both the experiences that were shared by folks that are struggling with this right now and some of the success stories that other bakeries have found in this area, things that they've done and how it worked, just ideas pinging off all over the place. And you could see folks just taking a ton of notes during that call. And that's the kind of thing that we do on the roundtable calls. The things that we talk about are generated by the community. The folks that are going to come on the call say, I would really like to talk about this. And we say, absolutely. We put it on the agenda and we have the talk. We've had calls in the past where we spend the entire hour or even 90 minutes talking about one specific thing. And then calls like this where we can hit three or four topics and drill into it a bit. The folks on the call, they're all professionals, but some are employees and some are owners. And that's a really interesting conversation when you've got bakery owners talking about struggles that they're having. And then you hear about things coming up from another bakery, but from an employee's perspective. And there's a lot of learning and connection that goes there. And I think folks leave these calls with a pretty good list of, okay, here's some things that I want to try at the shop over the next month until we get back together a month from now. So just putting that plug in there to check out Bakers for Bakers. If it's something that you've been meaning to do and haven't gotten around to yet, why not give it a go? Come and sign up and join in the fun. And let's learn together and let's teach together, okay? All right, on to the talk with Anastasia. So living wage, a topic that's near and dear to my heart and has been for years now. I've shared this story on the show before that when Cindy and I had Orange Boot Bakery back in Saskatchewan, one of the things that I always wanted to do was to make sure that all of my staff were making a living wage. We had a lot of young employees and some folks, you know, had left home for the first time in their lives and they're renting an apartment and they're coming to work for us at the bakery. Are we paying them enough that they can make their rent and that they can buy their groceries and that they can survive in the city? You know, I'm sad to say that we did not pay a living wage at the time back in Regina. It's always been one of my regrets. You know, when we closed the bakery, that was one of the things that I said, you know, if we're going to reopen, we need to figure this out. How are we going to set things up so our employees can make a living wage? That really gnawed at me. And now I get to experience it from the point of view of the employee working at a local coffee shop in Victoria, which is one of, if not the most expensive place to live in all of Canada these days. And I see the impact on my fellow employees when we're working there. We talk about that. And so Anastasia and the Living Wage for Families in BC program is designed to shine a light on this and to encourage employers to pay a living wage, but also to help employers get there and how to help them get their heads around what changes have to be made to start paying a living wage and what are the benefits of that? And then also advocating government and various entities to say, hey, it's too expensive to live here. What can we do to make some fundamental changes to actually lower the cost of living here so as that the burden isn't entirely on small business owners to pay their employees more and more every year because prices keep going up and up. So they're in a really interesting position to see both sides of this and to really advocate for workers and for employers, to be honest with you. And they do a lot of stuff to try and promote employers that are actually paying a living wage. So I've heard Anastasia for the first time on another podcast, local to Victoria. There are a group of restaurateurs here where I live called the Bread and Butter Collective, and they had her on a year or so ago, and we're talking about living wage right around COVID times, early COVID times. And then I got to meet Anastasia in person at the Baking Association of Canada Bakery Showcase back in Vancouver in May. And I'm delighted to have her on the show now so we can have a more in-depth conversation about the living wage program and how it applies to bakeries and especially, you know, the smaller independent bakeries that are near and dear to my heart. So here we go. Anastasia French. From across the water in Vancouver, Canada, and the Living Wage for Families organization in BC. Yeah, so it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thanks for doing this. The whole Living Wage program has been a huge interest of mine for a long time, so it's great to finally talk to you and dig into it a bit more.
Yeah. Excited to have this conversation. I can talk about living wage all the time, so.
Yeah, it's right up your alley, yeah. Hey, so I guess first off, I'm curious, can you tell me a bit about the Living Wage BC group and sort of how does it exist and how does it kind of relate to the other, you know, what's going on across Canada, that kind of thing?
Let's put
it in context.
Yeah, absolutely. So Living Wage for Families BC, we're a program of Vancouver City Community Foundation, which, as well as running Living Wage, also run like the BC Rent Bank and various other kind of programs to help, particularly on affordability, so housing affordability and other initiatives. At Living Wage for Families BC, we do three main things. So we work with community partners across the province to calculate what the living wage is. We certify companies and organizations that pay their staff and contracted workers a living wage, and there's now nearly 400 of them in BC, which is amazing.
Nice. Yeah.
And then the final thing we do is we advocate for government policies to make life more affordable and to hopefully increase wages. Although we're separate from groups in across the country, we work really, really closely, particularly with our partners in Alberta and Ontario, where there's live living wage campaigns that also certify employers. We meet kind of monthly and making sure that where we can, we have very similar either methodologies or policies, so that if there are any companies or organizations that work across Canada, they're dealing with very similar things, whether they're speaking to me in BC or Living Wage Ontario.
Yeah, right on. So it's not a government program. It's like a nonprofit advocacy campaign, which is
awesome. It's separate from government, and I think that's actually really important because it means that we can advocate at government.
Yeah.
So increase wages. So hopefully increase the minimum wage to maybe one day make the minimum wage a living wage. But even if we can't quite achieve that, and certainly won't do it immediately, looking at what government can do to make life more affordable, because that brings down the living wage, or at least stops the living wage rising, and makes it easier for businesses and other organizations to get involved.
That's one thing that I definitely wanted to talk to you in a bit when we get to talking about sort of my personal problem here in Victoria with how things have gone in the last year or so. But yeah, so because I saw a press release that you had done sort of pointed back at the city of Vancouver a while ago, right? About here's how even within government, like you're not living up to the same ideals for a living wage with the city of Vancouver, which I thought was interesting. You know, it's not like It's not like it's a government program going to businesses saying you should do this. It's like, no, across the board, let's talk about how we want to live here.
Yeah. And so we very much advocate for municipalities. And we'd also love it if the provincial government and maybe even the federal government could become living wage employers themselves. So they can practice what they preach, and they can make sure that all of their direct staff and contracted workers earn a living wage. The City of Victoria is a living wage employer, and have therefore made sure that all of their direct staff and contracted workers. And my understanding is in Victoria, the biggest difference is for the security guards. So most city staff already earn above the living wage because they're unionized, and unions do a great job of advocating to make sure that their workers are taken care of and can earn enough. Whereas often the contracted workers are the non-unionized workers. And so they're the ones who really benefit from a municipality becoming a living wage employer. Unfortunately, this year, the City of Vancouver decided to stop being a living wage employer, which was really disappointing. And what was even more disappointing, or maybe confusing, is that instead of paying their staff the current living wage, which for Vancouver is $24.08 an hour, which actually, interestingly, is less than Victoria's.
Yeah.
They decided instead to use the 5-year rolling average, which means that they're making sure that everyone is paying their workers around $20.20 an hour, which they claim makes sense from a kind of logistical perspective. And what I'd say in response to that is the increase this year was difficult, and it was really difficult for many organizations to administer, in particular small businesses. Like we heard really loudly and clearly, and in particular small businesses in the food and beverage sector really, really came with that. Whereas all the other municipalities somehow did manage to make it work and have managed to either lift wages immediately, or they're working with us and their unions, the unions involved, to make sure that once the collective agreement is signed, everyone is earning living wage and maybe even will be retroactively paid. So all the other municipalities have either managed to make it work or are making it work at the current living wage, rather than fudging the figures and fudging the numbers and trying to use a number from 5 years ago, which isn't really respective or relevant to the living wage right now. Because I think living wage right now is really important because of how expensive life is. It's a struggle for many businesses to do, I get that. But actually it's more relevant for people's lives than it's ever been, because the cost of rent and the cost of food is as extortionate as it is for everyone. And I think a lot of people are struggling right now more than actually they would have been 5 years ago.
Big time. Yeah. I know from my own lived experience, it came as a very sharp shock, you know, over the last, say, 6-8 months, just the rise in absolutely everything. And in our own case, because we rent, we were feeling like, okay, we cannot afford to move ever. Because it's like, if rents have gone up so much in the last year and a half, that if we were to move, you know, we'd be leaving the island for sure, right? Because there's just no way. Yeah, it's wild. Yeah, well, and so can we talk a bit about sort of what is the living wage, or when you do your calculations, what are you, you know, what does a living wage represent in real terms?
Yeah, so the living wage is the hourly amount that someone needs to be able to earn to be able to afford basic essentials. And so that's essentials like food, like rent for parents, like childcare. It doesn't include things like savings for retirement, paying off debt, which increasingly as life gets more expensive, those credit card bills are going up and people are having to pay additional costs to pay off those credit card bills. And doesn't include things like big vacations or anything like that. It really is a bare bones budget to make ends meet. And then the other thing that we do is we then offset any benefits that people, and particularly families with kids, might be getting from the government to help kind of lower that, and we put it all in a very complicated spreadsheet that I don't fully understand. And that's where we get the number for what someone needs to be able to earn to just make ends meet and to just get by. The living wage this year increased across the province, increased by nearly, I think, 19% in Victoria. And interestingly, as I mentioned, Victoria overtook Vancouver this year to be the most expensive city in BC.
Yeah.
And possibly even the most expensive city in Canada. And the reason for that is because although rent is now comparable in Vancouver and Victoria, it used to be that Victoria was a much more affordable place to rent than Vancouver, and now it's pretty much exactly the same, but it's more expensive to get food over to the island. And so that's why Victoria's overtaken Vancouver to the most expensive.
Yeah. But I think that's the point that I really take away from that is like, we're talking about, you know, if it's, you know, your stereotypical family of four, it's two people working full time, making the living wage is enough to make ends meet for a family of four if you're renting, but it's the basics. It's not you know, it's not like, hey, here I'm set for life kind of a thing. It's like, no, I'm not falling behind. Yeah.
It's the basics. It's about getting by. We include, there's no kind of savings for retirement or savings for anything. It really is just how can you keep afloat right now?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, and you're right, because it does, regardless of the number, you know, and I want to talk specifically about how things have shifted in the last year or so, but even, you know, if we were having this talk a year ago and it was around $20 an hour, and bringing it back to say food service or bakeries in our case, you know, the bakers that I've talked to over the years, I think we all sit there and we say, like, yeah, we would like to do this. You know, I'm not going to ask you the question of like, so why is it a good thing to earn a living wage? Because it's a given, right? It's like you, if you're working, you need to be able to make enough money that you can support yourself and support your family. That shouldn't be a negotiation, right? But you get that in our industry a little bit, where you say, but the industry at large has never really paid a living wage across the board for folks, right? And so I guess I'm curious, because I know you work with individual businesses, like, what's the conversation like to, first off, I guess, how much of your time is spent convincing people that this might be something to work towards versus people saying, yes, I get it, help me get there?
Yeah, so I'd say that our initial strategy was very much like businesses coming to us. And the more success we've seen actually is less, except for municipalities, which we've taken a much more proactive approach to trying to convince municipalities and government. With businesses, it's much more hoping that they will come to us and actually getting businesses themselves, who are living wage employers, to be proud about it and to shout about it, because that's when we then find ourselves a ripple effect.
Yeah.
So in Victoria recently, we had one moving company become a living wage employer, and they were very proud to tell everyone. And then suddenly 2, 3, 4 other moving companies in Victoria were all like, oh, hang on, I can do that. I can be a living wage. I can be a living wage employer if they can do it. And so we kind of want to change that, and we want to be a bit more proactive with our work and trying to work with employers to do that. There's several kind of different conversations we have with them. I mean, there's the making the case for a living wage. And I think everyone can understand the moral reasons for paying a living wage. And I think that people can get on with, oh, that's a nice idea, that's something I'd like to ascribe to. But I think that sometimes what's forgotten is actually the business benefits from paying a living wage. It doesn't just kind of make moral sense. It actually makes business sense as well. When in this time, we're hearing a lot about a labor shortage and how employers are really struggling to hire right now and retain staff. But actually, what the data shows is it's not a labor shortage when it's the people who are earning a lot of money. The labor shortage is the people at the bottom. I think the pandemic meant that people did a bit of a reflection on their lives, and they were like, I don't know, I want to be working this job which doesn't pay me very well and doesn't treat me very well. And so those employers which can attract because they can pay a living wage have found that not only can they attract better staff, but they can also retain them. And it also leads to increased morale, which can lead to increased and better business. So it kind of makes business sense as well. And also more money for the local economy. When low-wage workers get a pay increase, they're far more likely to spend that money and spend that money locally than when high-wage workers get a pay increase. So that's kind of all of those different benefits. But what we'd say to businesses, particularly in kind of sectors where actually that gap between maybe those workers are currently at the minimum wage, which is like $8 an hour gap between the minimum and the living wage, and they see that target and they're like, yeah, I'd like to get there, but oh my goodness, there's no way I can do that right now. There are a few different conversations. First of all, we do include benefits. So if, for example, you offer a health and dental plan for your staff, that lowers your living wage by about $2 an hour. So instead of a living wage of $24, you're looking at about $22 an hour for Vancouver and Victoria. Equally, if you offer any additional paid time off beyond the statutory minimum, that again lowers your living wage requirements. So there's different things that you might already be doing or can adapt your policies to make it a bit more realistic. And then the second thing we say is develop that plan. So you may even, after you've taken into account the benefits and everything like that, you may be looking at a living wage of $21 an hour and you're at 16. Maybe you can't lift everyone right now to $21 an hour, but maybe you can lift them to 18, 19, 20. Next year, you can maybe do 22. Yeah. Of course, the living wage gets updated every year, so the field changes a bit. But hopefully it just makes it a bit more manageable to get there one day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think it's that making that statement that says, the pay that we're doing or the wage scale that we're offering actually does have an influence on retention. Like they say, money isn't everything, but it's like when you're making $10 an hour below what you need to scrape by, it's a lot, right? You know, so, you know, and I think I mentioned the last time we chatted that I work at a coffee shop in town, and I'm part-time, and, you know, I'm only working like 16 hours a week kind of a thing, because I'm old and that's all I want to do. You know, it's sort of like, and so I'm not making a living wage at all. And that's okay, because that's sort of this, I do other things, right? And so I'm doing okay. But the folks that I work with, there's not a single other person that works at the coffee shop that isn't working two jobs, right? You know, like they're all working two jobs to get by. And the staff turnover that we're experiencing is insane. I've never seen anything like it, where it's like every week it's like, who's going to be there this week? You know, and it's just the spiral. And I think how I kind of think of it is it's like, if you're in that zone where it's like you're constantly rehiring and you know, even though you don't want to say it out loud, you know that, you know, people need work to get off from this job to go work another job just to make their rent and buy their food, that you're spiraling down, right? And it seems to me that if you're making this strategic decision to say we're going to get towards paying a living wage as a way to say that you can make your living here, right? And what does your business look like if all your staff are making their living here, you know, as opposed to this is just where I stand for 5-6 hours a day, right?
Yeah, and there's a group in Ontario of small business owners that have come together. They're called the Better Way Alliance, to try and kind of advocate for better business practices from the business community. And they have a calculator on their website, which business owners can use, and they can type in for how much turnover they're getting, and then how much if they were to give a pay increase, what the benefits would be. And it's all based on kind of the individual business and their own things. But it's a really interesting mechanism and device to see, actually, you can work out yourself the business case for paying better wages and the impact that can have. Because it costs money to train people. It also, if you've got a constant new stream of staff and stuff like that, you're more likely there are going to be mistakes that happen, and then there'll be inadvertent costs to the business that way as well.
Oh, yeah.
Realizing it is right now a difficult time for businesses as well as it is for individuals. Everyone is struggling right now. But it's what you can do in the timeframes and the budgets that you've got, and what flexibility you can offer. Even things like, for example, increasing the numbers of paid sick leave or vacation may not necessarily have the biggest financial hit to your business, but can be one way to kind of get you closer to that living wage.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well said. You know, and I think that's the thing, you know, and I've seen it, you know, with my own eyes this year, that cost of training, just in that, you know, when you're working in a kitchen, cost of training comes down to stuff you actually throw out because it's not done right. You know, like food costs go up, that kind of a thing, because you're just and you're constantly going over the same thing again and again. You can't move forward strategically because you're always retraining, right? Like, you know, like I can't bring on new products because I'm always training on the old products, you know, that kind of a thing, right? It's it can be a downward spiral as well. And I think from an owner's perspective as well, it's just that ability to be able to plan with a little bit of stability in mind, that it's less likely, you know, you're not going to get that text that somebody's quitting like all the time, right? You know, in your work, Anastasia, I'm wondering, has the conversation come up much about, you know, unskilled labor, and it's like, well, this is what we're paying, but it's for unskilled labor?
Yeah, I get that conversation all the time. If these people don't deserve to earn a living wage, and they're this and they're that. And I think our argument back is that the living wage principle isn't based on kind of the skills that someone has, but it comes from the principle that if you want to employ someone, you need to make sure that they can pay for rent and pay for food. So you make living wage the floor. And then from there, you then pay your skilled workers higher than a living wage. But at least it means that all of your workers, regardless of how skilled you might deem them to be, can at least afford to pay for rent and pay for food and pay for the essentials in life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Because I've heard that argument from, you know, the sort of, well, I can understand paying my bakers maybe, but it's like front of house staff. How can I pay my front of house staff that kind of money? And it's like, well, like, I don't know, a barista, that's a skilled job. Customer service is a skilled job, right? Like it is. You know, I've seen terrible dishwashers. I've seen very, very good dishwashers. That's a skilled job as well. Like there might be jobs that are perceived as more or less valuable, but it's like for the ship to sail, for that
that team to function. Everybody's got to be good at what they do, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting if you then do an analysis of what is deemed or what is seen to be unskilled work, and then do a gender analysis of that and a race analysis of that and an immigration analysis of that. And then suddenly you'll find that, that's interesting. In the UK, there was an interesting one. A big grocery store chain was paying their warehouse staff significantly more than the people worked at the tills. And it was kind of the investigation came out and it was like, well, actually, the people who work at the tills are all female and people who work in the warehouses are all male. Is it that actually both of those jobs are unskilled and yet you're paying one more than the other? Is that actually, is there a sexism angle to that rather than necessarily what you deem a skill thing to be? Which is where living wage again comes in to be a really good idea to kind of combat that, because it means that and research has shown that when a minimum wage goes up, the race wage gap minimizes and the gender pay gap minimizes, because you're at least making sure that you're lifting the wages of those people that are the lowest paid. And we do know that the lowest paid workers are predominantly females, new immigrants, people of color, or people who are already experiencing all sorts of other discrimination in life.
Or and the very young as well. Like, I get that one as well. Well, you know, so-and-so is just a student. And it's like, well, the way our society runs these days, they're carrying more debt than I am as a renter. Like, it's maybe folks are consciously doing it, but I think a lot of folks are unconsciously doing it. It's just traditionally front of house doesn't get paid as much, and or traditionally back of house gets paid more or whatever. And it's like, but it's like, what's behind those traditions, right? You know, it's those traditions need to be busted a bit here, and let's put some value on customer service, and let's put some value on what goes on in the front as well. Because
interesting, you know, my experience in conversations, it's the dishwashers that are the undervalued ones. Anyone can wash a dish.
You
don't need to earn very much whatsoever. The front of house, because of tips and stuff like that, make a bit more money. I think, and I hear a lot from, they're students, therefore they don't need to earn a living wage. And there's a few things to unpick. You're completely correct that students are carrying a lot of debt right now, and we don't calculate in the living wage kind of, we assume the calculation for taking like one evening class, but not taking on huge amounts of student loan and that kind of thing. And the other thing you don't know is what's going on in someone's life. So, for example, yes, you might have a 24-year-old who is living at home with their parents. And so the need might be, they don't need to earn as much. But it might be that they don't want to still at 24, 25 be living with their parents. And actually, they'd like to move out, and they would like to live with their friends or their partner or on their own. And we should be creating a society where that's something that they can do, and they can be there to do that and to achieve those kind of really minimal bits of independence in life.
So one of the things, you know, the unspoken truths is, you know, from a bakery owner perspective, is it seems like the only lever that you get to pull is price, you know, on that kind of stuff. Because someone's going to say, well, how do you pay for this if I'm going to make this move? And I'm wondering if in your conversations in the last year or so, is that the only lever that's getting pulled with businesses that you're talking to? And saying like, well, if I'm going to do this, I have to raise my prices. But is there other things that they're looking at as well?
I think every business owner has their own business, and they know their business model and their economics far better than I do. And I never, when someone is like, I want to do this, but I don't know how, it's difficult, because I can put them in touch with other business owners who might be doing similar things, but they've got their unique things about their rent, the rent that they're paying to their landlord, or whatever the specifics are, whatever their overheads are and their costs are. I think as well as looking, some of the trends I've noticed as well as, well, maybe we might have to increase costs, is changing the staffing structure. And in particular, in relation to the benefits piece. So you lower the living wage, as I said, because if you pay benefits, but part-time staff traditionally don't get benefits. And so would have to be earning more per hour to make up for it. And so some businesses are moving away from having lots of part-time staff to more full-time staff. And that works for some businesses. And actually for those workers, that's probably a guaranteed number of hours, which helps pay the bills a bit more than three part-time jobs. The other side of it is, though, that some people like working part-time jobs because it's the flexibility and the different things that they've got. So they're different things that kind of conversations that have been had. Or there's a delay. It might be that they give a dollar pay increase in January and then another dollar pay increase in June, and they kind of work through the kind of structures to get everyone up to the living wage. They're some of the different conversations and mechanisms that employers have kind of found to still pay a living wage.
And I guess that's the thing, like if you're trying to shift to that, if you're saying, okay, this is a strategic goal that I have, yeah, it might take some moves, and maybe even with, you know, to get over the fear of you know, new employees in the training curve, it's like, okay, you know, we're going to pay you the old salary to start. And then 3 months in, you pass probation, you're up to this, right? Might not meet your criteria right now at the Living Wage BC Group, but at least it's a transitional thing, right? It's going to get you, like, at least that's a step.
Yeah, and we do have various different flexibilities and exemptions for living wage employers. So, for example, we know that you may not be entitled to benefits until after you pass your probation period. And so if you are, if someone's on their probation period, they don't need to be earning a living wage so long as their probation period is like less than a certain amount of time and stuff like that. And also, so long as you haven't got more than 10% of your employees not earning a living wage because of whatever exemptions you've got in place. We don't want people to be hiring and firing just to kind of be like, to have the living wage sticker. I mean, that's a lot of effort to go through to put the living wage seal of approval. But we have got a few exemptions in place and bits of flexibility aware that there's certain reasons why, for one reason or another, someone might not be able to pay a living wage at a certain point in time.
Right, right. And so then I'm wondering about sort of feedback you've received, say from, you know, because I know there was a gentleman at your talk in Vancouver that has been a living wage employer for a while now and was talking about the benefits. But I was wondering if you could share sort of feedback you've received, you know, good or bad, from the employers that you've worked with and maybe the employees of those companies that, you know, over the time that you've been part of this and the feedback that you've been getting about folks making the move to being a living wage employer.
I think in terms of also the audience here, I think probably Spinnaker's is the most interesting example. So Spinnaker's is a restaurant brew pub in Victoria. They also run some liquor stores and various different things. During the pandemic, the owner of Spinnaker's finding light moment, but he realized that actually his workers were, to get them through the pandemic and to get the business through the pandemic, he needed to make sure his workers were going to be okay. So he made the immediate step when Spinnaker's reopened to lift everyone's wages up to $20 an hour and also to move to a tip pool situation. I think tipping is a whole other conversation to be had. But what he said was really interesting was it created, there was some tension from some of the front of house people whose tips went down, but actually the biggest benefit he saw was how it created more of a cohesion between front of house and back of house, two different kind of, they'd been a bit more competitive with each other. And as soon as they were moving to that model where, hey, we're all working together for the same thing, suddenly, for example, if back of house didn't have anything on, they would help with kind of folding up napkins and rolling up knives and forks and stuff like that. And it led to a more kind of positive working environment for everyone. They've struggled to kind of keep, because the living wage is so substantial, they've struggled to pay $24 an hour before tips, which is currently our policy at the moment, but they have guaranteed that everyone earns $24 an hour when you include tips. And they've also moved to making sure that any staff who aren't tipped workers, for example, those in their liquor stores and stuff like that, earn at least $24.29 an hour, and that's their starting wage. And so it's really great to see that kind of commitment, and it's because he's seen the difference it's made to his staff and also to his business.
Yeah, there's a conversation going on right now on the Bakers for Bakers community about tipping, and one of the bakers in New York State did that similar kind of a thing where he said, okay, we're going to guarantee a certain level of wage here that includes tips, and it's sort of like if the tip we'll top it up if we have to, and if you're making above, you're making above, and that's how we're gonna do it. To kind of close that living that wage gap.
And that's something we're looking at the moment. So Spinnaker's don't do that, but what I heard is that it never drops below $24 an hour once you include tips. But it is something to look at, because at the moment we say you can't be a living wage employer, you have to pay $24.29 an hour before tips, because tips can be really uncertain and there's a lot of bad things about tipping and we know all of those things. But we're also aware that right now we basically lost all of our living wage businesses that depend on tips because it's not feasible for them right now for lots of different reasons. So we're wondering and we're exploring whether there should be some flexibility and if there's some way to top up wages if it drops or for something like that. But it's all, yeah. That's a whole lot.
I've just loved it. There's so many things in this world that need a radical rethink. And I think tipping culture is one of them, but it's like, you know,
North American and it's ingrained in the culture here, in a way that I can see it's probably not. And you see a lot online of when Europeans go to America or Americans go to Europe and it's just different kind of systems and ways things have been developed. I do think it was right though, a couple of years ago, the minimum wage changed so that the minimum wage is the same whether you work in a grocery store or whether you're a liquor server, to make sure that you're at least earning the same money and there's not that discrepancy, because discrepancy is what leads to a lot of problems.
Well, and we've mentioned a couple of times how in Canada and definitely like Vancouver and Victoria and across BC, over the last year, the living wages jumped a ton. You know, and I remember you shared the stats about, well, why is it increased so darn much, like $4 an hour, you know, or 19%? And it was rent and food, you know, is the two things. And so when you're in food service, you're getting the food hit double, right? Because your employees are all, suffering, plus everything coming through the door from your suppliers has gone up as well, right? So it's a real double hit for employers. Well, and I think you mentioned it, but I know it's tough to make a jump like that in a year, but I'm curious for the folks that haven't been able to make it, what have you heard from them in terms of, okay, I'm not going back. Are they going back to the old way? Or are they sort of like, okay, it's going to take me a while, or what's been the response, I guess, from the food service folks when the jump was that big?
Yeah, I think there are some businesses in Victoria looking at the tips thing in particular, because I think they think they can make it if you include tips, and whether or not there should be adapting to include tips and that kind of thing. But I think also there's a lot that are maybe hoping that one day it'll come down. And I hope maybe one day the living wage might come down. It came down in the past, but the reason it came down in the past wasn't because life got cheaper, but because of government investments in childcare and family benefits and things like that, that have really, really helped families with children. I don't think the living wage this year is not going to go down. We have not seen costs come down. Inflation has come down a bit, but that doesn't mean that costs are coming down. It just means that things are not quite increasing at the price that they were before. Policy is that rents are just rising. Every month we hear a new average rents in Vancouver and Victoria, and it's unaffordable to live in those cities. Or if you are lucky enough to live, you've got somewhere, you're protected by rent control, but you've still got one eye thinking that at some reason your landlord might find a reason to evict you so they can increase the rent by 20%. The living wage isn't going to come down this year. I mean, so I think that those businesses that have backed out, they're looking and maybe they can get there in a year and in 2 years. They've got lots of other issues that they're working with all of those living wage employers that haven't been able to stay part of the program. We try to, as much as possible, keep a good relationship with them, and hopefully one day they'll be able to come back. The only one where we've taken a bit more of a passionate approach is with the City of Vancouver, because we believe they can do it, and it's much more manageable for them to do it than when I'm talking to a bakery or whatever. The other thing to say is that I actually am surprised by how many living wage employers managed to stick with us. We had 380 living wage employers in November last year. We've still got 380 living wage employers. We've lost about 60, 70 employers, but we've had 100 new living wage employers join. And so for everyone we unfortunately lost, we've had a new one come through the door. So that's good for us. But it is a challenge. And with the living wage probably going to go up again, it makes it a continued challenge for all of those employers. So it's kind of working with them to hopefully make sure they can stick with the program.
Well, and I think what gives me hope with organizations like yours and the way you're positioned to kind of advocate back to government is that, like, you're sitting there saying, hey, if you want to make everyone's life better, you need to go after landlords and you need to go after the grocery stores, right? And it's like the crises that caused price increases have passed and the price increases are still happening. And, you know, my ice cream's $10 and the container's smaller and I'm upset. But anyway, sorry, I got it personal again. But the thing, you know, but it's true, right? It's like you're not, and that's going to be a whole different podcast, but it seems to me that if you've got some pretty big contributors to overall cost of living for everyone, and it's like if you want to make change that benefits everybody, that's where you have to go, right? Because
yeah, and I'm really interested in what solutions we want to propose for the food piece. I think there's been a lot of conversations over the past 5 years about housing and how to make housing more affordable. And new affordable housing is being built and money is being invested. The reality is, though, that even with all the money in the world and all the best will in the world, it'll still take 5-10 years to go from idea and funding to actually an apartment someone can live in. So there needs to be stuff to happen in that kind of interim period. But what also can be done on that food issue, because that is the thing that every time any of us go to the grocery store, I play a little game with my friends where I'm like, this is what I got. How much money was it? It's about $5 an item, whatever it is, it's $5 an item. But what can be done? So it's targeting the grocery stores. The provincial government say that's out of their control. It's a federal issue. I don't know how true that is or not. The federal government are giving money in the form of grocery rebates, but the reality is that the money that they're giving is not as much as people are paying for things. Where is that policy change going to happen and what is it going to be? And I'd love to work together and bring together businesses and nonprofit groups and food banks and all of the people who are passionate about food security to kind of help address those issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you get to push in two directions, right? On the one side, let's get wages up to meet the costs of today. And you can also affect things by saying, okay, let's lower the cost of some major things for everybody, right? And see how that goes. Yeah. Which breaks my brain, but I'm glad you're thinking about this and I'm glad that you're working on it for sure. You know, it's like I'm sitting here from the perspective of you know, the small business owner, or in my case, a former small business owner that wanted to do this, you know. And I don't know if I shared with you, but like when we owned our bakery in Saskatchewan, we weren't in old dollars, it was $18 an hour was the living wage. And the most we were able to pay folks was like $16.50. Like, but it always bothered me. It always felt like our business wasn't fully functioning, wasn't fully successful if we weren't able to do that, right? If we were starting people at 14 when they needed 18 to live, right? It didn't work. I wish that you existed in Saskatchewan when we had the bakery, because I would be talking to you about like, okay, help me get there, you know, help me think about this differently so I can get there. So, yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that what we do is we work closely. We're trying to make sure that there's living wage movements across Canada. So there is a group, the CCPA calculate the living wage for Saskatchewan. At the moment, they don't have the resources to run a kind of program like we have here, but working with them, hopefully looking at how we can give them the resources to maybe do that so that we can have living wage campaigns across the country. Because also when we speak with large employers, we're talking about the kind of like, if ever Loblaws decided they wanted to pay a living wage and wanted to be a living wage employer, they would come back and be like, but there's no living wage for blank, or there's no program here. How do we make it work? So we know people have kind of cross Canada numbers and figures in a program so that we can attract those big employers, because that's what will make the difference. That's what's going to increase the biggest number of wages and have that. But the thing that I really love about living wage is on one level, you're right, it's a big scary concept that is like, oh my goodness, how can I, in the same way that climate change or poverty or any of these things are really big scary concepts, and it's like, well, that's too big, I can't do anything about it. What I really love about living wage is it's something that everyone can do at whatever level. If you're a business owner, make that plan to bring everyone up to a living wage. If you're a government, if you're a politician, like what policies can you do to both make life more affordable and to increase wages? If you're a consumer, making sure that you shop in those businesses that do pay a living wage, because that will encourage more other businesses to be like, oh, if they're getting more business because of it, I should do the same.
Yeah. Well, then you're actually doing things on the marketing side of things for these small businesses. Like they can put the sign up or put the sticker up that says we are a living wage employer, right?
And yeah, absolutely. They've got stickers and plaques and everything. The more promotion they do, the better that is for us, the better that is for them. We want everyone to shout about it.
Because I think that's the thing. Like you can, you know, speak, okay, this is a big deal for me. And that's certainly something that I would seek out, right? You know, if I've got the choice between three places in town here, I'm going to go to the one that's a living wage employer. In the same way as a baker, that I was would always go to a bakery that there was a guild member that owned the bakery, right? Because you know you're getting the good stuff there, right? And it's the same. It's as, to me, it's as strong as a quality signifier as we're organic or we're local or what have you, right? It's and I guess maybe that's the challenge. To folks that have poured a lot of their investment into we're local and we're organic, but it's like and our employees are able to make their living here, you know?
Well, and often those are the businesses that do, because you get it and their values driven. And you've got various different stamps of approval that exist out there, whether that's B Corp or the BC Green Business or different kind of stamps of approval, but all of them, or those two that are just being wage as part of it. And so the biggest way to get that point is to prove by starting by being a living wage employer. So we're grateful to be one of those kind of ways that a business can stand out as a kind of ethical business because of how they treat their staff.
Right on. Right on. Well, thanks. So what have I missed? Is there an angle here that we haven't dug into?
I don't you say, but if anyone's listening and they're like, well, who is a living wage employer or what is the living wage? Our website has all of the information on it, livingwageforfamilies.ca, I think, or just Google Living Wage BC. It'll come up. No one types in the URL anymore. It's just Google. It, on there, you'll see, I want to know what the living wage is. I want to know who is a living wage employer, and I want to become a living wage employer. And all of those, that will take you through and give you all the information you could possibly want.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much. No, I really appreciate this. And I'm hoping that this conversation is going to spur some more conversations with the bakery owners that listen to the show and the bakers working in bakeries that are listening to the show and say, okay, how do we better have these conversations as owners, as employees, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if any are listening and have questions or feedback, always open to how we can improve or do better or ideas, then just get in touch. The contact details are also on the website.
Right on. Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. That was fun. Challenging and fun. Back when I worked at SaskTel, back in you know, the first phase of my career, Kim Whittle was our chief technology officer. And whenever I go talking to Kim and we'd be hashing out problems, you know, like big problems that were facing the company. And he used to say, you know, well, if this were easy, we would have figured it out by now, as a way to say, like, you can't always just figure things out and just make one change and everything works. And if you're a bakery owner and you're not paying your staff a living wage today, it's not that you don't want to. In most cases, you know, I don't know of a single bakery owner that's like, no, I prefer it when my crew can't afford to make rent. You know, keeps them on their toes. People don't talk like that, and they don't think like that, but they do think it's very, very difficult to make the structural changes required to pull this off. And it's true, it is difficult to make those structural changes. And so I'm really pleased to have talked with Anastasia about some of the things that folks are doing to decide to make that commitment that this is what we want to do, and then set a plan to get there and make the changes over time to get to that point where everyone on staff is able to come into work and not, you know, live in fear that they're not going to make rent next month or that they're going to have to find a second job to pay for things and that kind of a thing. And so, you know, it's a difficult thing. We have a culture, especially in North America, but I really think it's more than North America, that food's supposed to be cheap and service is supposed to be cheap. And yet, you know, you go into most bakeries that I've ever been in, it's the guys on the customer side of the counter that are making the living wage, not the folks that are behind the counter. That's something that I really hope changes. And I'm really happy that there are groups like the Living Wage for Families group in BC that are trying to promote the benefits of paying a living wage for all employees, and to celebrate those employers that are, you know, we celebrate local food, we celebrate organic food, we celebrate fresh food, all of that. You know, we celebrate farm to table, we celebrate a lot of things. Let's celebrate the fact that everyone that's serving you today at the shop is actually able to afford the basics in life. You know, that's a pretty good thing. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoyed having it. I really enjoy sharing it with you. Until next week, when we are back with another conversation, can't wait to share it with you. Work hard, bake lots, stay safe, stay healthy. Happy baking. Bye-bye.